Well, our moms think we're funny.
Okay, hey everyone, I am Akomi.
Hey everybody, this is Turk182.
So, we were trying to start this podcast and we got sidetracked by what we thought would make for a pretty interesting podcast? Pretty interesting Let's Watch.
Yeah.
And, didn't wind up being super great, so no. we're trying yet again.
Yeah. So this is one we've been wanting to talk about for a while and try to get some more information about. And unfortunately, we couldn't get like all as much information as we wanted to about it. It's one of those things that's not well documented. It's not as far as we can go. Like you follow that guy Wendigoon, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I, you know, people like that are used to doing these kind of stories. They have avenues and they know kind of where to go to get the information about, you know, whatever story they're talking about, whether it's an urban legend or it's this or that. They know, like, here are the sources I can hit up to get that information. We unfortunately don't have that. So it's kind of a bunch of Google searches and going down rabbit holes that don't necessarily pan out.
Sure.
Which yeah. I gotta say, I fucking hate when I do a Google search for something and then it'll give me all these search results and somewhere in one of the different results, it'll have the, like, whatever my search query is.
Yeah,
and you'll see it in there and I'll click on it and then it's nowhere actually in on that page or whatever.
Yeah,
I'm like,
yes.
But you showed it here. Now go back and I'll see, like, okay, it's in this little sentence right here. And I'll go back there and I'm like, okay, like it's not there or it's not that at all. Like, I'm like, you're wasting my time here. After a while, I get frustrated. I hate to be aggravated. So,
you know, the workaround of that?
What?
Quotation marks.
I've tried that too.
Yeah.
There's another thing to, you can do quotes, but it's something else you can do to kind of like zero in or,
There's a lot you can do, but if you do minus then a word, then that excludes that word from those things.
Oh, that would be why whenever I try to look up X-Men, I just get X.
Yeah. Well, if you do X, like, then a space, then minus men, yeah, you would just get X. Mm. But,
So this is the story that, that I heard about from, I don't even know exactly where I heard about this. I think it's something that, I didn't see it on Reddit, and it wasn't something that somebody told me. It was like an article that I saw or something about it, and I was like, okay, like, that's kind of strange. And you read it, and you just kind of dismiss it. And then later on, I was like, it kind of just came back to me. So, because it's been years since I heard about this thing, and again, I just kind of dismissed it as like, okay, whatever. And then it just kind of like popped in my head one day and I was like, oh yeah, I remember that thing.
Right.
And,
right.
And I was like, what was that again? Was that real? Or like, yeah. You know, and so I started looking up and I was like, okay, here's a couple things. I'm like, all right. So then I talked to you about it and I was like, hey, you know, and I tried to do a little bit more research to kind of narrow it down or whatever. And so today's episode, you know, something, you know, we occasionally actually do some, quote, real, like, podcast topics and everything instead of us just screwing around all the time. And this is on something called the Detroit Partnership Graveyard.
Yeah.
Again, I couldn't find
it. My graveyard. Can't have shit in Detroit.
Especially not water. you know, and I got to say, I think that what's happening or what has happened in Detroit is kind of a bit of a travesty. I actually mentioned this at work one day when we were, like, during Christmas time, you know, we were, we just kind of had a little bit of like a holiday gathering, even though we're all remote and stuff.
Right.
And we were talking about stuff and I mentioned, I'm trying to get back to where I was again. Damn it. I just had it in my head here. It wasn't about this, crap. It just completely left my mind where I was going into, cause you said we can't have, Detroit. There it is. So, I was talking about like landmarks and stuff and how they had, you know, they tore down CBGBs And I was like, you know, CBGB's, you know, was like the birthplace of like the punk movement in New York.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I know if you really want to get like down into it, there are other places and stuff like that. But, you know, as I remember it, CBGB's was, cause I watched a bit of a documentary about that. And then there's like there was a punk documentary too that I watched some of, and I want to watch the rest of, but it was, I just haven't had a chance to like get the rest of the episodes and watch them. But CBGB's was this bar they opened up in New York in the 70s, and it stood for country, blues, bluegrass, country, bluegrass, blues, CBGB. There we go.
Right.
Country, bluegrass, blues. That's what they were going to play. But, you know, they weren't getting a lot of like country and bluegrass artists, but there were some young bands that wanted to play there, up and coming punk movement. And so you had bands like the Ramones and New York Dolls, Blondie, and mm-hmm. those kind of groups that were looking for places to play. And so CBGB's let them play there. And then it kind of like took off, and more bands started playing there. And then that kind of grew from there.
Right.
If you want to see something that, maybe I was a little bit off about being busted.
Yeah. She's not too bad.
It's a different one than I'd have to find it, but it's not important here. I want to stay focused on this thing. if you want to see something like frightening, absolutely frightening, look up pictures of the bathroom at CBGB's. So like on your phone, like just look up pictures like CBGB's bathroom, and oh my God, I would shit myself before I would go into that bathroom. Like if I was a drug addict and I need to score, and they're like, dude, you can go in the bathroom and shoot up, I would immediately get sober. That's how
CBGB.
That's how bad that place, that bathroom is. Just, I could not. And I think Iggy Pop played there.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's how it looked modern. Like, disgusting. Wow. Absolutely disgusting. And it became it became like a staple thing too, with like, well, now that's just like the look of it.
Yeah. So I will say I would never want to do drugs in there, because I feel like that is a bad trip waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If I absolutely had to piss in there, and I mean, you know, that's possible. You're in a club, you're drinking a lot. I would probably have to piss in there. I don't think I would wash my hands, because I can promise you my dick is cleaner than whatever the fuck is going on in there.
I think I would actually stay in the doorway and just angle that shit up. like shooting a rocket into space.
So, yes, that is a very, very busy, busy, busy bathroom.
I mean, you could have two virgins go in there and fuck, and they would both come out with, like, AIDS, hepatitis, like, gonorrhea, like, and only touch themselves. Like,
everything imaginable.
Yeah, I mean, like, oh, man. Yeah, so... But they closed CBGB's, and they tore it down. And, like, but that's an iconic, like, place. I mean, it's historic.
It's a historical landmark, yeah.
But they couldn't save it even being a historical landmark. So bringing that back to Detroit, the Motor City, the birthplace of Motown, right?
Yeah.
And it's a fucking, it's like hellhole of a cesspool. I mean, it's not that bad, but I mean, all the stuff that's, it's no longer the place that it used to be.
Yeah.
It's just declined and nothing like, but think about everything it gave us. It gave us, like, again, you know, the Mercedes, where the cars were being built, like Detroit. And then, you know, you had like the music and everything. How does everything just fall apart to like nothing? Obviously, when you like move the automobile plants out of there, like they did with Flint, Michigan, and move them to like Mexico and shit like that. And that doesn't help. And anyway, all of that kind of stuff was, but still, at some point you have to like remember who we are as a city.
Right.
And
right.
Not let it fall into this thing. Cause now what you had that used to be this, like, this historic landmark of a city, like this, everything we gave to this country that, you know, in a sense made it great because it reached out to everybody here and just kind of like, they like lifted them up or like sent people in different directions and stuff to make things, you know, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, they created like really great like musicians or whatever. It's like all stuff, and then you just let it all fall to the side, and then like you know, someone goes back, oh yeah, this is where like R&B started, like this like Motown, like all these great acts started here, like there,
right
there, like you know, like ugh. So like I say, it's kind of a shame that kind of what Detroit has come to. It's like, and you look at Detroit now and you're like, we're never going to get RoboCop. We're never going to get RoboCop. Cause look at Detroit. Like if you ever needed it, this, like you need him now, but there's nothing there in Detroit that would facilitate building him. Like,
right.
Yeah. So, but in Detroit, you have, there's this thing, and I'm assuming it still exists to this day. And it's the Detroit Partnership. So I'm going to read a little bit from Wikipedia to talk about the Detroit Partnership because it is.
Yeah. Because, like, you know, you mentioned it and I haven't been able to find a lot of information on it.
So, this is, integral to, or integral, however you want to pronounce it, to the, what we're going to be talking about, the Detroit Partnership Graveyard, or what has been referred to as the Detroit Partnership Graveyard. So I'm going to be very clear on that. Like this isn't an official thing. Like, you know, like a Bigfoot sighting or everything. It's like, you know, Bigfoot Sasquatch. Like we never have any proof that, you know, this thing exists. So you can call it whatever you want to.
Right.
Cause it doesn't have an official name. Same thing here, but it's been referred to, most of the time as I've heard it as the Detroit Partnership Graveyard. And again, it's a lot of speculation. So I also want to make sure I make that very clear too. There is nothing concrete about this. It's a lot of speculation and people inferring that these events happen in this way. But I don't think you're ever going to be able to get anybody that's going to say, you know, for a fact, you know, like that this is how these things played out. But anyway.
Right. Yeah.
As far as the partnership itself goes, that is well documented. And again, I'm going to read from Wikipedia here. So the Detroit Partnership, also known as the Detroit Crime Family, Detroit Combination, Detroit Mafia, Zarelli Crime Family, and the Tocco Zarelli Crime Family, is an Italian-American organized crime syndicate based in Detroit, Michigan, and mainly operates in the greater Detroit area as part of the larger Italian-American mafia. They hold interest in Windsor, Ontario, Toledo, Ohio, as well as other cities in Michigan, Ohio, West Virginia, Nevada, and Sicily. So it goes back here, it goes into like the early years.
You know how we know that they're Italian-American?
Because they tell you?
Yeah.
And I know a little about organized crime, too.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot about crime families because I am Italian.
So it's kind of funny here. Like, it starts off with the Gianola Adamo War back in 1912-1913.
Mm-hmm.
And it says here, these three brothers were grocers and fruit peddlers. They first came to the attention of authorities in late 1911 when a grocery store was raided and police confiscated $2,000 worth of stolen olive oil. So you have to think about a crime family now and then back in 1911 when, like, they were in possession of stolen olive oil. That's what they were selling, like, was olive oil. Like, that was their big crime thing. Not drugs, not this, not that. Olive oil. Like,
that's
kind of funny.
It's like, nowadays it's mountains of cocaine.
Yeah. So it's just like, wow, that's interesting. Weeks later, the mutilated corpse of a former Gianola associate was found charred and left in a field. This person had allegedly tipped off law enforcement to stolen merchandise found in the basement of the Gianola store. The murder of this guy, I'm not saying his name, just because I just don't feel like, you know, getting that much into it, established the Gianola brothers as feared force within the Italian underworld. So I get it. You know, someone rats you out and everything. You want to make an example of them, right? Cost you $2,000 worth of merchandise in 1911. That's a lot of money in 1911.
Oh, right? Yeah.
But again, like, you killed some guy and burned his body over olive oil. And I fucking bet you $1 million they doused his ass in olive oil when they set him on fire.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say they probably used the olive oil as, like, the fuel. So, yeah, would not surprise me. Although, speaking of, like, stupid crimes and, like, money being worth a lot more back in the day, have you heard about, like, America's first bank robbery and how the guy got caught?
Mm-mm.
I mean, like, there's an entire-ass story behind it. Hugbees on YouTube did a really good, like, retelling of it. So, like, there's an entire-ass story behind it, but to briefly summarize, because I don't want to, like, take away from this, the guy got caught because he stole, like, whatever it was back in the day. It was like $17,036. Very, very specific number. And then 2 days later, he went back into that exact same bank where he had an account and was like, I would like to make this deposit of $17,036. The exact dollar amount of what was stolen. So that's how he got caught. And there's like a whole lot of other factors to it. It was like people getting like accused, and like it was like this whole thing with like yellow fever scare and all that. But that is the Cliff Notes version of what happened. It's like he stole a very, very specific amount of money and then immediately came back and was like, I'd like to deposit this, please. This is definitely mine. I obtained it through perfectly legitimate means. So
these guys then moved on to try and take over, like, Gianolas were trying to take over, business from the Adamo gang. And back then you were talking about, you know, it wasn't drugs or guns or this or that. Like, there was racketeering, and then it says here, like, illicit beer, because this would be during, like, Prohibition and stuff, and, or just make, just, you know, like, you know, obviously, whenever there's something, some kind of merchandise, or that people want, there's always a market for it, a cheaper, like, version of it that I can sell, like, you know, at some kind of price, you know?
Right.
I mean, which, of course, that's how we get shit like, you know, Wish.com and Temu. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
So then the two gangs, right, kind of were going back and forth, and they were gunning each other down, you know, again, it's racketeering, you know, but, you know, racketeering. And then you've got the alcohol, you know, in this case, they talk about beer, but I'm sure they've then progressed into other forms of alcohol. And there's this whole, like, war. So that continued on between, like, the Gianola gang and the Adamo gang. And then it went into, the Gianola, Vitelli war. So the Gianola brothers had aligned themselves with, John Vitale, who entered the liquor business. And then the Gianolas and the other, so it just kept going on. Then they were fighting, and like, it's just basically gang war, like all these different gangs and stuff. And they're, you know, they're just like, just duking it out, like all over the place. And of course, as it's going on, you've got family members that are being killed from like the main families and stuff. So, I'm trying to get to the part here, where they get to the, and this is progressing on like throughout like Prohibition. So I'm sorry, Prohibition started, I think, in like the, 20s. Yeah. So the early on, it wasn't quite Prohibition yet, but then Prohibition started in like the 20s. And of course, that didn't last very long. And then it was bootlegging and stuff. And then we're getting up to like the 1930s. And again, now you've got the crime families going back and forth. 1930, 1931, there was the Crosstown Mafia War. So, it says here, this is another mafia personnel or person in the mafia, Mazzallo, because I'm just kind of skipping through here, had been recognized as one of Detroit's top bosses since the early 1920s, and relative stability had reigned within the local underworld throughout this time. But by 1930, continuing mafia rivals based in New York and Chicago concerned the Castellamarisi. Wow, that's a name, dude. I mean, Castellamarisi. Like, I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad name. Like, that's a name. Like, Castellamarisi.
Yeah.
Allies directly. Smooth. Yeah. Concerning the Castellamarisi allies directly involved Milazzo at the heart of a volatile situation with New York's, mafia. You know, they were being opposed by its boss. Ongoing feud. So everything's just kind of like boiling off. So you've got this, in Detroit, you've got this fight that's going on with the crime family there. You've got a crime family in Chicago. You've got one in Detroit, and that are, you know, like, you know, all fighting for pieces of, like, you know, area Detroit and everything else. And it's really kind of getting out of hand. Well, obviously it's a mob war, so it's going to get out of hand.
Right.
And then, like, you've got, like I said, you've got killings all over. This is really documenting, like, the whole, like, back and forth between who killed who and who killed what. And of course, whenever you lose top people and especially members of the family that are directly linked to the bosses, that just fuels things even further. So we get to the establishment of the Detroit Partnership. There's during the Castelmorese War. So after the death of Gaspar Malazzo, a war ignited within the Detroit Mafia. At the same time, the Castelmorese War in New York had officially begun. And during this time, Chester Lemaire, with support of a powerful new New York boss, Joe Masseria, was recognized as the new Detroit boss. So it says, Lemaire went to hiding while more than a dozen mafia members were killed in Detroit during the East Side Gang, West Side Gang War that went on for about a year. And then he had the assassination of a New York Mafia boss of bosses, Joe Masseria, in 1931. So it says, the death of New York's two old world style mafia leaders signaled and solidified the rise of a young modern mafia leader, Charles Lucky Luciano.
Holy shit.
And his supporters known as the Young Turks. Under leadership of Luciano and the allied leaders within New York's five families came the establishment of the Commission, the ruling committee of American Mafia. Under the New York Mafia's new regime, which included bosses Charlie Lucky Luciano, Joseph Joe Bananas Bonanno, Vincent Mangano, I apologize if I'm like butchering these names here, Thomas Gagliano, and Joseph Profaci, the Detroit Partnership was officially recognized within the Italian-American underworld's new organizational structure. The powerful Midwest crime family became one of the 24 original mafia crime families that comprised La Cosa Nostra in America and began its dominance within the Michigan underworld. This is in the 1930s, 1931.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay.
I did not realize there were 24 families initially in La Cosa Nostra, so that's very interesting.
So, it says here that you had this guy, Angelo Melli, Black Bill Tocco, and Joe Uno Zarelli. So they were the allies, with John Priziola and Peter Licavoli, who became part of the Detroit Partnership's ruling council. So that's, you know, that's them coming together in this to form the Detroit Partnership, which was then recognized by the five families, which gave them legitimacy. So the Detroit Partnership is formed. So you've got these, basically the different, mafia affiliate, I don't want to call them gangs, but families. That have all come together under a single leadership.
Right, right.
And the leadership could depend on whether it's going to be like, because I think you've got within this you've got the Italians, and I think there was also I'd have to go back and pull it up here because I read this whole thing like a long time ago. But you had the Italians and the was it the Irish? I think that, but
there was an Irish mafia. Yeah,
yeah. I think those are the ones that kind of came together. It could just be just various Italians. So forgive me if I'm not absolutely clear on that part, because this is not where I really want to get into.
Yeah, this
just
got to lay the focus,
right, the foundation. But then when one of them dies or it's got to be passed on, then the ruling council decides who is going to take over. And I think that still goes back to like the five families to be able to say, yeah, this person can take over.
Right.
So they've pretty much been running things like during that time. And the Zarelli era, says here, lasted from 1936 to 1977. So Anthony Joseph Zarelli taking over as acting boss or of the Detroit Partnership around 1970 when the elder Zarelli went to semi-retirement, but it was short-lived as the old man, as he was known to his peers in later years, was called out of retirement until his death to lead the crime family he helped build over the part of the five decades due to the untimely imprisonment of his son and successor in 1974. So his son Anthony takes over. He gets thrown in prison, so then the old man has to come out of retirement to take over and run the family again.
Right, right.
So the imprisonment of the younger Zarelli and one of his closest associates, Michael Santopolizzi, also known as Big Mike, because they had concealed their ownership of the Frontier Hotel and the casino in Vegas, the old man was basically forced out of retirement to leave excuse me, of the highest levels once more. So they, these guys got sent to prison. So this guy had to come out. So Anthony, Tony Jack, Giacalone, he came in, a little bit later, but they got a picture of him here, right? He looks like he would kill you just because he didn't know what time of day it was.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it didn't even matter if he asked you. This is not like, like Chicago, like it was like, you know, as I was walking down the street one day, like no, he's just walking down, it's like, I don't know what time it is. Bam, and he would just shoot you for no reason. Like
he does look like a very dangerous guy.
Yeah, he, I mean, just like if I saw him come, I would probably go home and just move. Like like if I saw him at Walmart, I just passed in an aisle and just saw him like looking at dog food, and I was like, dry or wet? I'd be like, fuck. Like, I would just leave my cart where it was, go home, like, packing, I'm leaving.
I would definitely want to give him a wide berth. Imagine, like, being a waiter and, like, getting his order wrong.
I mean, he's one of those guys, you look at that face and everything, and, like, it's, like, you feel like nothing you say would be the right thing. Like, if you were just like, oh, you walk by him, it's like, oh, excuse me, sir. And he'd be like, what the fuck do you say to me? Like,
yeah,
or if you just like, just kind of went by, like, there's enough room down the aisle that you don't have to say, excuse me.
Yeah.
Right. But if you went by and didn't say anything, like you, there's no way, like, you could go down that aisle at all.
Yeah. There's no winning either way. Yeah, no, like, I just think about how that convention staff was like shitting bricks with Neil Adams that day.
Oh yeah.
He was like, well, you know, I paid for a 15-foot space. So, you know, it's fine. I'll take the sign down so it's not 15 feet, but I paid for 15 feet. And just how nervous that staff was, that's what I'm picturing with that, where it's like, you know, I did ask for cream and sugar in my coffee. And it's like, oh, God. Yeah. Oh, God. We will do everything in our power. And that's, no, it's fine. It's fine. You don't have to bring it. But I asked for it. It's like, oh, God. He's going to kill my family.
Because even if you do bring it, he's like, I told you didn't have to do that.
You know, I asked you not to do it this time.
Now, so. Like, now you're making me look like an ass. Like I forced you to do that.
He's
like,
you're just batting 1,000 here with not doing what I asked you to.
He's like, okay, I'm just going to shoot myself. And it's like, you know, it's like, see, now you're trying to rob me of my vengeance? Like, I can't win.
Like, I can take it away from the table. I can take the cream and sugar away from the table. Well, now you're putting words in my mouth, and I don't appreciate that. You know?
I just want to put coffee in your mouth.
I just want to live. What do you want from me?
So it says here, Anthony Giacalone, I'm hoping I pronounced his name right, gained national fame in 1970s with the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa. Prior to then, there had been growing tension between Hoffa and several mafia members who opposed his plan to return to prominence in the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The latter included Giacalone, Anthony Provenzano, and Giacalone's brother Vito. On July 30, 1975, Hoffa disappeared after he had gone out to a restaurant to meet Provenzano and Giacalone. Giacalone had not been near the restaurant that afternoon, though he was suspected of being involved in a conspiracy to murder Hoffa. Giacalone was later jailed for 10 years in 1976 for income tax fraud. You know, always a RICO act. That's really pretty much the only way you can get that you can actually, like, get a mafia person is RICO.
Right.
I mean, that's how they got, the Teflon, what was his name? Teflon Don.
Oh, shit. I don't remember.
Yeah, but I mean, it's always that. Because not that I'm praising a crime family, right? But, like, you keep shit tight, you know? Whether it's loyalty or fear, whether it's, like, fear loyalty or whether it's loyalty fear, you know? Like,
right.
Whatever it is, like, you keep shit tight and nobody says anything. And so you've got no proof of anything. Like, and it's, you know, it's like, I don't know. I didn't see it. There was a dead body in your car. It ain't my car. It's like,
it fell off the truck.
Like, but we found you driving the car. No, I was just sitting in the car. So you weren't driving it? No, I was just sitting in it. But why were you sitting in the car? I was tired. I needed a place to sit. Door was unlocked. I sat down. Like,
yeah.
It's like, that's the kind of shit. Like, I'm not saying anything. It's like, well, we're going to charge you. You got to do what you got to do. I know what I didn't do.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that body.
I've got a lot of respect for the way the mafia does things as opposed to a lot of, like, crime things. It's like, for them, it is strictly business. And that's what Capone always said was, you know, I am just meeting a need. Mm-hmm. Like there is a demand for the service that I offer, so I offer it and I make money. Like, yeah. It is as simple as that. So even though, yes, it's morally reprehensible, it's illegal, it's a crime, blah, 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 I gotta respect their approach to it.
So have you heard this the story about how Rudy Giuliani became the mayor of New York?
No.
Okay. So I've heard this, and I've never done any research because I didn't really care that much. But I'm just gonna put this out there. This is the story that I heard. And if you want to know how true it is, whatever, but from my understanding, this is pretty much how it is. So the Italian crime family used to kind of run things in New York.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They did not like Giuliani. And I will say this.
Can't really blame him.
Early, like Giuliani, when he was the mayor of New York, like, he's the one that turned around Times Square. He was the one that said, we've got all these, like, these buildings that've got busted windows and stuff like that. We need to replace those windows. If they break them, we'll replace them again.
Right.
Right. And it's like, because this is making everything look bad if we keep leaving it like this. And he's kind of brought around that revitalization of New York to where you had it in, like, the mid 80s to where you got it to, you know, like, in like the 90s, you know,
right,
and then into the 2000s. And so like everything you see in like Times Square now, I'm not gonna say that's all him, but he's the one that started that and kind of getting things moving to like, this used to be a beautiful, like, you know, like vibrant city. Like, let's bring that back. Now I'm sure there's a lot of other moving parts in the air, and he probably wasn't the one that came up with the idea, but it was under his mayoralship or whatever.
Right,
those things. So, of course, you know, he's going to be credited with the bulk of it, whether he had that much to do with it or not.
Of course.
But,
yeah. Politics for you.
But he wanted to, the Italian crime families didn't really like him. He wanted to be mayor. So he got the allied with Russian crime families,
mm-hmm.
which came in and pushed out the Italians.
Yeah.
And then the Russian crime family basically took over New York and, you know, and then helped him to become the mayor.
Interesting.
But the bad thing is, at least the Italian crime families, you know, obviously their roots go back to like, you know, Sicily and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But they had been rooted in America and in New York for so long.
Oh, yeah.
That's where their allegiances were. Russian crime families.
Yep.
Their allegiances to Russia.
Yep.
So you just gave them not even a fucking back door. You gave them a key straight into their, like.
Yeah.
And when you look at it, you'd be like, oh, that's why the Italians didn't fucking like you. You know, because you're a moron.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is a thing with, like, organized crime, that there always seems to be a certain loyalty to your turf.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's because, you know, that's where your money is. So, like, of course the Sicilian Mafia is going to be, like, fiercely loyal to New York because that's their business. But, you know, I mean, you see the same thing with, like, the Yakuza. They have done more for Japan in the wake of, like, natural disasters than the Japanese government.
Yep.
You know, they're usually like, hey, Prime Minister, fuck you. This is our turf. We're going to fix it before you have the time to get through the red tape.
Right.
So I find that kind of thing, like, super interesting. But yeah, like, the Russian Mafia, they are very frightening.
Yeah.
And the cartel is very frightening because they don't seem to have those same qualms that, like the Sicilian Mafia or the Yakuza have.
And they don't seem to have the territorial interest of, like, we're going to take care of this area. Like, this is our turf. This is our area. We're going to do whatever we do here, whether we're selling drugs, whether it's prostitution, whether it's guns, whatever. But we're also going to make sure that it stays, neat, clean, you know, like, under control, even if it's under our crime control.
Yeah.
Unlike people that don't have a vested interest in that area that are like, yeah, I don't give a shit if it goes all goes to hell as long as my money's coming in.
Right, right. And
it's like, yeah, but you have to understand that part of your money coming in also relies on that that place staying a viable location.
Yeah, yeah. Because
when everything breaks down, like these motherfuckers don't have jobs or places to live to be able to get your money. Like,
Oh, that's the thing. Like, when I was first learning stuff about the mafia, you know, I'd always heard about, you know, the protection racket. And so you hear racket and you think scam.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like, oh no, they were like actually protecting people.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's bad. Yeah. It's like, okay, if you don't pay me, I'm, you know, then you're going to need protecting from me.
Right.
So, you know, it's not a good thing, but it was like, well, as long as they were getting their money from people, they protected them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if somebody came and fucked up your store and you were under my protection, I would go kill them. And it's like, okay, well, that's, you know, that's pretty interesting. There's a lot of stuff that people don't know because they don't look into it beyond the movies.
Yeah. Like you said, the protection racket, because, so, I mean, you think about the protection racket as being like, oh, here's this crime family. It's like, oh, yeah, so if you don't want us to fuck up your place, you're going to pay us. Well, it's not like that. It's not like that they're threatening you, like, we're going to... It's that we are a crime family here, but we're not the only one in the area.
Right,
so you could, you know, technically get hit, like, every day this week from a different crime family asking you for money. And if I hit you today... And then they go to hit you tomorrow. Well, guess what? You don't have any money tomorrow because I took it today.
Right.
So then they're just going to fuck your shit up. But yeah, you pay me and I'm not going to take everything. I'm going to take a fee. But then also, if somebody comes to you tomorrow, guess what? It's not happening.
Right.
No.
Right.
So yeah, it's a crime. It's a racket, but they're also, like you said, doing that job.
Yeah.
They're doing that job. So in a sense, they are still protecting you, even though part of who they're protecting you from is them.
Right.
But unlike, let's say, I don't know. I just top of my head. I'm not even trying to concentrate on it. Just like, Venom. I'm like Venom. Who I'm going to, you've got the guy, you got the guy that tells you every time that what a protection racket is.
he's got to explain it to you, like, looks into the camera.
And then Venom's like, oh, yeah, well, you don't leave these people alone or anything. This is, yeah, I'm going to give you this warning. Fuck the warning. Like, you know, I'm just going to kill you. Like, okay, whatever. But, so that's kind of the origin of the Detroit partnership. Okay. And the people that, the family that runs, you know, the organized crime family that runs Detroit.
Right,
And again, even though this is documented in that manner, again, it is, you know, still speculation. It's not like on the books. It's not like they have a big sign that says, welcome to Detroit, you know, home of the Detroit partnership.
Right. You know? Yeah.
These guys don't wear name tags. Hi, my name is.
What?
Detroit partnership. Zarelli crime family. And of course, you know, like, depending on who becomes the new head, they take, you know, different people take over as that. And it, so going back, as I said, like, going back to the early days of the Motor City, and, you know, you've got the automobile industry there, you had all the factories there, people were, you know, it was kind of thriving. It was a factory town, you know, but then you also had, you know, had Motown, and Berry Gordy, had that stuff going here. So the city had a lot going for it. And then things started kind of like taking a downturn.
Right.
So you had a relocation of things, especially when we've got the automobile factories in, you know, they're building up and you've got a shift, you know, like more, like factories being built or different like car manufacturers, but you've got, you know, different cars that are coming in, that kind of stuff. Anyway, so you got a lot of things changing there and you've got people that are moving. You know, because you didn't really, I mean, you had suburbs, but you didn't really have, like, suburbs the way we have them now, like, you know, back then. So you've got you've got people kind of, like, moving, like, from the cities to kind of, like, on the outskirts of the city to suburbs. And you always had people, I shouldn't say always, but you have people that worked in factories that lived close to the factories. And generally, the housing and everything that were close to the factories were, I don't want to say lower income, but their property values weren't as high because what's surrounding them? Factories.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, it wasn't like in the city where you've got all these, the bigger businesses and you've got, like, the names of this and everything because, like, the people that work in the factories, they made a decent living, but they didn't make a lot of money. So you're not going to put, like, a, you know, some like, I was going to say Macy's, but Macy's isn't that big deal, but like a Bloomingdale, something like that out there, because those people can't afford it, you know, and they're probably not even shopping because they like, there's nothing there that they really interest me. I can get everything I want from like the Woolworth, you know, like, So, you know, it kind of stays that the people that, you know, that live next to the factories, you know, like their property value isn't that high. And then you don't have like all the upscale stuff. So then you've got people that are kind of moving out. And of course you want to you want to live closer to where you work, but you don't want to have to drive, you know, especially back then you want to have to drive all in and stuff like that. And then, you know, getting into like the '70s, you had the formation of OPEC, and then you had the whole gas shortage and stuff like that. So, last thing you want to do is be driving like, you know, 30 minutes into work every day and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So you had, and also you had the, you had cities that were built, you know, in the 1900s, and they were built using the resources, skills, and the knowledge of the 1900s. So then you had sewer systems, that were built, you know, using like lead pipes and, you know, and like different kind of construction that didn't hold up well over time. And of course, you had like lead seeping into the water and stuff. Those things have to be replaced. Now at the time they were fine, but then, you know, those things have to be replaced. Then as you've got electricity, obviously growing through the city by the '40s and fifties and stuff. And I say forties, fifties, they started sooner than that, but. Earlier than that, but you've got that kind of going through there. But as things start to grow, especially when you've got factories, they require more electricity. You know, they've got to make transformers and things like that, like towers closer to there to get the energy. You've got to run more electrical wires. And then when you start to get into like the 60s and 70s, I think that's when they started running more stuff underground too. So that means digging up those things. And then, of course, you're like, oh, we've got to restructure this and move these things around to make these things better. So with everything changing, people moving like out from like that part of the area there, and you've got more factories being built, things are, the whole landscape is shifting. And so they had to redo the entire sewer system there, and they've got to replace pipes. They've got to do this. They've got to reestablish. They've got to run connection there to areas that they didn't do before, because you've got houses that are now opening up and, you know, being built in like new subdivisions.
You've got
apartments, complexes that are being built like in the city and that kind of stuff that now are going to require we've got a sewage line and water that are coming through. But if you're going to build an apartment complex here, those need to be bigger to accommodate more. So you've got all this stuff here. And then if we're replacing all this stuff and we're kind of like, rerouting, like where it flows and how it goes through. Well, where we used to have some houses here, like these areas here, like people have moved out of those areas. Those houses were abandoned or they've been torn down. Now they're parking lots or they're overgrown. As we're like redoing this whole like sewer system, we don't have to worry about these areas here. Like, we're not going to replace those because they're not active really. We don't have anything there. If a factory is going to come in there, you know, when you build a factory, you've got to build a foundation. They're going to tear all that shit up anyway. They're going to establish their own and then connect it to our new stuff. So there was whole sections of like the city where the sewer system was left untouched. They just basically closed it off. Like we're going to disconnect it from what we're doing here. Because if we connect it, we're connecting like old pipes and everything to new pipes, and that's not going to solve like the lead problem or anything else.
Sure.
And so we're just going to just disconnect them and just leave them there. So that's all throughout like all of Detroit. You've got these areas here where just these little pockets, they could be like anywhere from a city block to several city blocks, depending, you know, running in like, you know, in various directions.
Sure.
So when we got to the, was it the 70, was it 75 or so? When the, Jimmy Hoffa went missing. Okay.
Yep.
So when Jimmy Hoffa went missing, there was a big deal about that. It was like, you know, Hoffa was, he was a big name and all eyes were on Hoffa. He had done a lot. And then out of nowhere, he just went missing. And it was like almost immediate when he went missing.
Yeah.
It was like, he was supposed to be at a meeting, like last time he saw it was at this diner or whatever, and then like no one saw him again.
Yeah.
He was just gone. And of course, there was a lot, you know, where he was good for the Teamsters and for, I guess, the crime families that he was working with. As you said here, like, they weren't really down with what he had, what the direction he was going in, and they didn't want him in control anymore.
Sure.
So, and that was all throughout, like, the media, right? It was well known that there was some tension there. So when Hoffa disappears, like, it's a big deal. And, you know, so this is, 1975, July 30th, 1975, when Hoffa disappeared. And there was a lot of, people, they were looking all over. And of course, the first thing you're going to do is they're going to turn to these crime families, right? Cause they're like, okay, the mafia and Hoffa, they weren't getting along. And so if he's disappeared, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at the crime families.
Right, right.
And they're going to start following some of these people to see where they're going to lead. You know, they're probably doing wiretapping. The police are, you know, FBI, they're harassing some of the lower level guys that they think they can break and stuff to get some kind of lead or whatever. And in the mafia, you know, the crime families, they don't really want to necessarily say mafia. But they knew that.
Right. Yeah.
And they knew that they were being, whether they were involved at all, they knew that they were being more actively followed and under more scrutiny than normal, which put a big damper on a lot of their activities.
Right. Yeah.
You know, cause obviously they're the mafia. So like most of what they do is illegal, or even the legal stuff they do was obtained through probably illegal means. So, you know, you don't want to draw attention to yourself, especially when you've got everybody. It's one thing with just like the local police and you're buying off judges and shit like that. But when you've got the FBI involved and all that kind of stuff,
yeah,
it becomes a much bigger deal because you've got people with it that like the police have this kind of jurisdiction. These guys have all over jurisdiction and they can do shit that, you know, they can't. So, you know, it kind of made them, not slow down, but be a lot more careful with what they were doing. So as the story goes, when the city started doing back in the early to mid 60s, when the city was doing the whole replacement of the sewer system and restructuring of that.
Yeah, yeah.
The areas of Detroit where the sewer system was kind of left abandoned because they were, you know, they were just like the more, I don't want to say rural, but the, I guess, urban sections that were possibly going to be turned into factories or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they closed up a lot of those things and they, like, you know, I don't know, they bricked them up or locked them up or whatever. But they're still accessible.
Right,
I mean,
yeah,
manhole covers or whatever, or there's always some kind of other passage to get in there. And you can't make them completely inaccessible because you're sealing those things off, but you're not draining them in any way. So there could be gases and things like that building up in them that you got to monitor and all that kind of stuff. But they weren't being used and no one was really like, you don't have to worry about like sending people in there because of the, like, you know, the sewage system is blocked up here or whatever, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So the story as it goes, is that some of the crime families, and I say, you know, some of the crime families, obviously we're talking about the partnership here, were using those abandoned sewer lines to dump bodies. So as either people, like, you know, they're running crime there. Like, nothing comes in or happens there that is not under their control.
Right, yeah.
If it is, obviously they're going to shut that down. And normally if you come into a place that, like, I'm going to run shit here and I'm going to sell things, you know, whatever it is, like, even if it's not something that they sell, you come into their territory and you're going to sell something and you haven't asked them, no, that you're gone. So when these people get taken out for whatever means it is, then you've got to dispose of them.
Of course, yeah.
Well,
it's not like, you know, you've got the Hudson River or whatever, like,
right,
other places.
Well, you just happen to have these abandoned sewer lines that no one goes into. What a better place than to, and they're all over the city. So it's not like it's one place you're putting this, they're all over the place.
Sure, yeah.
You're dumping them in there. No one's looking at them. No one's really even thinking about them. As opposed to trying to get them out of the city, like putting them in abandoned cars and setting them on fire, that kind of shit, putting them in dumpsters. Why not just get rid of them altogether? Especially if you've got some kind of like small time gang or hood or whatever it is that comes into town that the police probably we don't even know has come into town.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why leave a body there for them to try to, for them to investigate or anything else?
Sure.
Someone comes into town that's not even on the police's radar. Next thing you know, they're gone. No one knows they were there, so no one knows they're missing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then other people, like crime families, like, oh, what happened to this person? Well, they just disappeared. Where? No one has seen them. Nobody has shown up. Like, they're just gone.
Yeah.
Well, if you got no clues to even, like, go nowhere to look for them, like, you, they, well, then they're just gone. That's the only thing you say is, they're gone.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So they was, at the time, this was not known. So, and we still don't know, again, to this day, because no one's gonna come forward and say this is true or this is not true, but based upon the stories, what little reporting there was, and the supposed evidence, mm-hmm. this is what was happening. They were dumping these bodies in these various abandoned sewer lines.
Right, right.
And they've been doing this since they were officially abandoned, you know, back in the mid-60s, you know, when some of those were officially cut off. So for like a good 5 to 7 years or so, or 10 years, like you had bodies being dumped in all these various locations that people were just, again, disappearing.
Right, right.
In some cases, they weren't necessarily disappearing because no one even knew they were there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, and that was fine until Hoffa disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When Hoffa disappeared, and now there was this big hunt for, like, where is he? These people must know something. And they were like, okay, we've got to play everything cool. We got to back off. We got to slow down here. We've got to do all this stuff. And also, we got to stop putting bodies in the graveyard, in the graveyards.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know what they called them at the time, but I'm just using that because it's referred to again, you know, as the Detroit Partnership Graveyards.
Sure.
We've got to
sure.
stop putting bodies in the graveyards.
Yeah. Right.
Because even though they're not looking for whatever it is we're doing, if they're following us trying to find Hoffa, they follow us to one of these dump sites, they find it, and then there's all these bodies, you know,
mm-hmm.
and when you've got like two guys that get caught dumping a body, they find, you know, in this one place, 10, 20 bodies there.
Yeah.
These guys
yeah.
aren't going to take the rap for 10, 20 bodies. They're going to roll.
Right. Right.
And we're not having our big made guys that are doing body dumps, right? These are lower guys and everything
mm-hmm.
that have no compunction about squealing and stuff because, you know, especially in something like that. Cause I mean, hell, you get caught dumping a body that leads to like several bodies.
Yep. Yep.
That could be tied to several people. Oh, you best believe that the state's gonna make a deal with you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you're gonna get witness protection, all that kind of shit and everything. It's like hell no. Like, you know, again, crime families or any kind of successful, like, organization, whether it's legal or illegal, these people aren't stupid. And there's this right, whole belief yeah. that, like, that crime families or, like, any kind of criminals are dumb. You don't get to the level that you are by being stupid and by affiliating yourself with stupid people.
Right, right.
So they stopped it. They shut it all down. Like, we're not using these anymore. Bam, it's over. So around that time and everything, the belief is that they stopped dumping bodies there. Well, you've got these stagnant, like, sewer pipes and everything, whatever was in there that, that's just sitting there kind of festering in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You've got fresh bodies that are being dumped in some of these various locations all over the place. And they're kind of capped up. When you say that we're not using them anymore, they're now completely abandoned. Every once in a while, you might get like a manhole cover that's lifted off and like a horrible noxious gas going to come out there. That also vents it.
Right.
When you stop using it and you've also added a bunch of dead bodies there and you haven't used it for like 5 years and those things have been capped. Yeah, that's bad. Eventually,
yeah, yeah.
that's going to seep out because, again, we're talking about these old sewer lines that were already deteriorating.
Yeah, yeah.
They're going to continue to deteriorate. And the more shit you put in there, the faster that's going to happen.
Right, right. Yeah, the gas will just continue building up and all that.
Right. So, in somewhere around, like, maybe 78 or 79 or so, there's no exact time periods, there were reports of, like this rotting smell, these smells that were emanating from various places in the city. And the different businesses were reporting on that. And they're like, there's some kind of toxic smell or something that's there that's going on. And of course, you know, around the 70s, you had like the, even though I don't think they had anything there, but you had like nuclear power. You know, there was a bigger scare about, like, you know, nuclear waste and different things, and you have some kind of like noxious gas or whatever it is. People are concerned about that, especially if you don't know where it's coming from.
Right, right.
So there were these gases, and they're doing these tests. They're going out there, and they're using those I forget what kind of like meters that he used for measuring, or like the gas and stuff like that, for, because, you know, you can use those meters that'll tell you like what percentage of like what particles are in the air, right, or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they're doing tests, but they can't pinpoint anything. They know it's in the area. And of course they're going to check all the new like sewer lines, right? Because that must be where it's coming from.
Sure.
None of those are panning out. They're not anything. And, you know, and depending on how the wind blows, like, it smells horrible today. Tomorrow it doesn't.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you, I used to live, before I moved to where I am now, I used to live, in these condos, and we lived right there on the water. And, it was like a small, the James River kind of ran, because, you know, James River goes from like the Atlantic Ocean all through Virginia.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was right there. It was on one of like the inlets, or whatever, the James River. So in the summer, it'd be kind of hot, but then that breeze coming off the water be cool.
Yeah.
So, you know, we opened up the patio doors, because we're on the third floor of this condo, and the windows, and it was great. Like it was really cool. And it would be, you get this nice like breeze coming in there. It was nice.
Right, right.
On the other side of the water from where I was this some kind of like seafood or crab, I don't forget what they did now. But anyway, I guess when they were done cleaning the crabs and stuff like that, they would burn the crab shells.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing, I shouldn't say nothing, but the smell of burning crab shells is disgusting.
Well, yeah.
It is. And that smell would come through, and it's like, it would make me sick to my stomach. It would make me so nauseous, and it would give me a headache. And I would have to close my windows. It was like, that smell would just like, it was horrible. So like, when that wasn't there, like, depending on how the wind was blowing and everything, you'd have this great cool breeze that would come through. And, you know, like, you would open up like the patio door, and then like the door to like the back room. And so it just went right through the house, just kept there nice and cool and stuff. It was beautiful. But when that smell came through, if the wind hit the right way, or they're burning, like, oh my God, like, I would just feel it in my head just start to pound, and my stomach just start to turn.
Oh, yeah.
Turn,
yeah.
Like a, you know, like a washing machine. I was like, oh my God, it was horrible. So you know, like, it's kind of the same thing. Like, some days the wind or whatever it was cool. You wouldn't really get much of a hint of it. And the other days it was apparently really strong. The smell like emanating in these different parts. And it's different parts of like, of the city.
Right.
And so it's kind of hard to pinpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, like, I think by like the early, so this is going on for a while, but it's sporadic. By the early 80s, it has increased. And now it's gotten to the point where you can pinpoint it, and they know it's not coming from the new sewer lines. It's not a sewer backup or anything like that, right? So, so they start kind of following that, and they follow it to one of the old abandoned sewer lines. And of course, they've kind of forgotten about it by now. It's been like 20 years almost. They uncap it, and one of the sewer workers goes in there and finds these decomposing bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's some rats and things have gotten in there, because rats always find a way, right? Oh, yeah. Right?
They get everywhere.
And it is just, like, apparently the most disgusting, horrific thing ever. And when they uncap that, it was one of those things where, like, it was so bad that, like, you know, people are immediately getting sick. I'm just sure like some people pass out.
Yeah.
Right. It's just like, whoa. Cause you're not expecting that. Obviously you're going to apply some kind of mask on or whatever, but you're used to going into the sewers and stuff, but not like this.
Right. Yeah.
And then they're like, what the fuck? Where did all this come from? And so it became a big deal. So obviously those sewer workers then, when they're like, whoa, they immediately backed out. And of course, you know, they had to bring in hazmat, and they're like, there are bodies down here. That means that you've got to bring in the police. You've got to bring in, you know, like, you know, the FBI may come in. You've got forensics has got to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you've got, and then they're like, where are the locations that the people were reporting this smell, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so they go and they start checking all those things out, and they're finding that there were these different abandoned sewer lines. And when they went into them, they were finding bodies. Not right, all right. of them. And when they say abandoned sewer, it's not like it's one like pipe or set of pipes, you know, because not all of them are big enough for you to walk through. Sure. You have your main ones, and you can have your smaller pipes that go through. And of course, everything's going to lead down into, you know, like Nemo, everything's going to lead down to the sewer. But then you had some that were a little bit bigger right, that yeah. would go like a couple blocks, either a couple blocks straight, it might turn or whatever. So they go in there and, you know, they're finding this, and it kind of goes back. And I think my understanding from what I read, in some cases, when it was a longer, like more than like a block or something like that, it may have stretched like a couple of city blocks, and maybe it turned or whatever. You would find bodies a few bodies, like way at the far end from where the entrance was.
Right, right.
But it was kind of like one thing, like over time, people just got lazy. As far as instead of taking them all the way to the end,
sure,
they just started like dumping them closer and closer and closer. So close to the entrance, you had a mass of them. Then you had more like further back.
And so
they start uncapping all these things and like finding these bodies. Now, how many bodies they found, I don't know, but supposedly it was between, like over that time period, it was between like 100 and like 20 or so to like 200 bodies. Mm-hmm.
Right there, folks, that was Our Moms Think We're Funny. Let's give them a hand.